Iran's exiled crown prince, Reza Pahlavi, wraps up his first visit to Israel with a speech at the University of Haifa. We ask Pahlavi's hosts how he reacted to their research aimed at helping Israel prepare for potential combat with Iran's Islamist rulers.
I don't think that he has any conflict with what we are doing today, but he is trying to portray what a bright future will be when the regime will be changed in Iran.
Plus, an arms control researcher's view of the U.S. sanctions campaign against suppliers of parts to Iran's military drone program.
I think at the very least, it makes their lives much more difficult because it requires them to take a series of steps in order to sort of get around or try and evade the sanctions.
And later in the show, an update on Canada's efforts to hold Iran accountable for the 2020 downing of a Ukrainian passenger plane. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Iran. Good morning. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. Exiled Iranian Crown Prince Reza Pahlavi concluded a five-day visit to Israel last Friday, his first to the Jewish state, by appealing for more Israeli support of Iranians seeking to free themselves from 44 years of authoritarian rule by Islamist clerics. The U.S.-based Pahlavi is the most prominent opposition figure from the Iranian diaspora to make a public visit to Israel, the main regional foe of Iran's rulers who ousted his father from power in a 1979 Islamic revolution. Pahlavi conveyed his appeal to Israelis in a keynote speech at the University of Haifa on April 20th.
The call to action is now, and our messaging to Israeli citizens, to the world over, is stand in solidarity with the Iranian people. Help us bring maximum support. Give us all the tools and the means that they need to overcome this evil regime. And they have already demonstrated they're going to die for freedom. They know where they want to go. All they need is an extra hand. And I hope that as a result of this trip, I've been able to attract attention to the issue, to prove to the whole world that the Islamic regime in Iran is an aberration and not the norm.
For a look back at Pahlavi's visit, I spoke on the phone Monday to two university staff who attended his speech, retired Israeli Rear Admiral and politics professor Shaul Chorev and Iran researcher Alexander Grinberg. I started by asking Chorev what kind of help he thinks Israel realistically could provide to people in Iran seeking regime change.
So I think that morally, if Israel support the people in Iran, and I know that they are broadcast to Iran from Israel in the Persian language, and to mention to them, besides what think about the regime of Iran, that is threatening Israel, that we are holding very good relation with the Iranian people, cultural relationship. And in Israel, we have a community, and this community is influencing Israeli culture as well as other things. So I think that the main message that the people in Israel are conveying to Iran is that we are supporting them morally, even though the regime is considered to be a harsh regime. We think that the Iranian people, we can have a very good common ground to speak, a culture and the aspiration of both people.
Alexander, you know, something else that the people in Iran who want regime change are asking for, they've been asking for a while, is not just a moral support, but practical support, you know, help with internet access and things like that. Are there any tools that you think Israel could provide that are of practical help to the Iranian people?
Well, I'm not a web expert, but I think that yes, in principle, Israel could elaborate and develop better tools to bypass internet censorship in Iran and other tools like that. But I think also that it is not specifically an Israeli domain, because I believe that services that Google or Microsoft can provide to Iranians are way better than what Israel can provide. But yes, it is also another way. But I'm also certain that these things must not be made publicly.
Well, yeah, Shaul, as you know, the Iranian government, has long called for the destruction of the Jewish state and any obvious or overt support to protesters in Iran would be used by the Iranian government to tarnish any protest movement. So how much of a risk is there that any Israeli support could backfire?
I think that we are aware about how to handle this issue, because you're right. If you expose people, then they can be treated by the government. And I think that what we need to do is to express and to know how to reflect what people are thinking, sometimes to interview them without giving the names, but to do it very authentically. So one hand, not to give the Iranian regime the opportunity to look after these people and to punish them, and they are doing it very harsh. And in the other hand, to do it authentically, that the people who are listening, and I think that there is a big community in Iran listening to the Israeli broadcast, will know that it is authentic.
Well, Alexander, you are a fluent Persian speaker, as I read from your bio. Can you tell us what you might be hearing from people inside Iran or even in the Iranian diaspora about their feelings toward Israel and what kind of relationship they want with Israelis?
Well, I would say that overall, most Iranian protesters don't care about Israel, because Israel is not the main concern of Iranians. But overall, yes, what I can see, even some voices in Iran, that the attitude toward Israel is either neutral or positive, and I don't think that the regime can tarnish the image of protesters using Israel for that purpose. Of course, it is always trying to do that, but it doesn't work. But this is the situation overall. But we always must remember that Iranian protesters didn't manage to topple the regime. It is the regime that takes strategic decisions.
Shaul, Reza Pahlavi, in his speech at your university, said that he was observing the research that you've been doing on this long-running kind of shadow conflict that has been going on between Israel and Iran, and that he hoped, you know, future research would focus on friendship between Israel and Iran rather than negativity, was the word that he used. So how much of a challenge do you think it is to develop a friendship with a diaspora figure such as Pahlavi when Israel has been planning for years about what to do if it feels the need to strike his country militarily?
I think that what he's trying to say, that it's when peace will come to the world and we say the Messiah will arrive, then wolf will live together with a worm. But that's what he's trying to convey. Currently, we are doing researches dealing with geostrategic, geoeconomic, and geopolitical issues concerning Iran and the region. And unfortunately, we have to deal with issues related to security. What he is trying to say that when in the future there will be a regime change, we can maintain our research in another field. Because in the past, and my uncle, for instance, in the 70s, he worked in Iran supporting them to develop the water irrigation system. So speaking about what can be done in the future when peace will prevail about the relationship, it's a different thing from what we are doing now. So I don't think that he has any conflict with what we are doing today, but he is trying to portray what a bright future will be when the regime will be changed in Iran. And that's the way he's describing it.
And Alexander, just to kind of wrap up the conversation here, how realistic do you think it is that we will see this opportunity for a friendship to develop between Israel and Iran?
I don't think, unfortunately, that any such development is possible unless this regime exists. Yet, I want to reinforce what Shaul said, because the cooperation that existed prior to the revolution of 79 expanded to all the domains, including desalination plant, the island Kish, and other domains in such as medicine, science, and culture. In Israel, the great poet Farouk Farrokhzad, her poems were translated into Hebrew and so on, and I always communicate in a nice way with Iranians abroad. But overall, it's still, unless the regime exists, I don't think that it is possible. And the last thing that I would like to say, that now it is clear, judging by what one can see on social media in Persian, that strikes by anyone on the assets of the regime is not considered by most Iranians as strikes against Iran as a nation.
Well, gentlemen, we'll have to end it there. Retired Rear Admiral Shaul Charev, political science professor at the University of Haifa, and analyst Alexander Grinberg, also at the University of Haifa, Esri Center for Iran and Gulf States Research, speaking to us from Netanya and Givat Shmuel in Israel. Thank you for being on Flashpoint Iran this week.
Thank you, Michael.
The Biden administration has taken more action to try to curb Iran's production of attack drones that the U.S. and its allies say have been used against them across the Middle East and in Ukraine. On April 19th, the Treasury Department sanctioned a network that it said helps Iran to procure components for the drones. It said that network includes Iranian electronics maker Pasna and its front companies and suppliers in Iran, Malaysia, Hong Kong, and mainland China. The Wisconsin Project on Nuclear Arms Control is a U.S. nonprofit research group that advocates for stemming the spread of weapons of mass destruction. I spoke on the phone to its executive director, Valerie Lindsay, and asked how she determines whether the U.S. sanctions campaign is effective.
I would say that it's difficult to measure exactly the effectiveness of sanctions. There's not a direct line you can draw between, you know, the imposition of sanctions on a series of individual entities and, you know, limitations in Iran's program. But I would say that the sanctions on Iran's military drone program are relatively new. And so I think it's too early to tell how effective they can be. The more recent sanctions have also, I think, have a greater chance of impact because the sanctions themselves are kind of overall financial blocking sanctions as opposed to trade restrictions, which had been what the administration had used previously to go after Iran's supply network.
Can you explain to our audience what is the difference between trade restrictions and financial blocking?
Well, in the case of trade restrictions, these are sanctions imposed by the U.S. Department of Commerce, and they, you know, prevent designated entities from trading with U.S. companies or obtaining items that contain U.S. technology, whereas these financial sanctions that are imposed by the U.S. Treasury Department are these full financial blocking sanctions. So it prevents entities trading all around the world from conducting transactions that touch or involve the U.S. dollar. So even if they don't enter into the United States physically at all, the chances of involving the U.S. dollar in one way or another, just because of the pervasive use of the U.S. dollar, is just much higher. So they're more likely to be restricted in their trade.
Have you seen through your own research that companies in Asia, for example, that are accused of supplying the Iranian program, are they hurt significantly when they have these kinds of sanctions, the financial blocking sanctions put on them by the U.S.?
I mean, it depends a bit on the nature of the entity. A lot of the entities that have been sanctioned recently are these smaller trading companies or perhaps distributors or individuals running small trading companies. So I think at the very least, it makes their lives much more difficult because it requires them to take a series of steps in order to sort of get around or try and evade the sanctions. So at the very least, again, it becomes sort of costlier for them to do business.
Can you tell us about the methods that Iran and its suppliers use to get around and circumvent sanctions?
Well, the methods that Iran uses on drone-related procurement are not unlike the methods that it's used to evade, you know, sanctions on its nuclear program and its missile program. So using sort of transshipment through high-volume trade locations like Hong Kong, using front companies, using aliases, using circuitous shipping routes in order to kind of mask or obscure the destination of the items. Most recently, and we've seen this in some of the designations, the use of kind of Iranian individuals located overseas, including in China, and operating a number of different companies out of those locations.
What methods do you and your colleagues at the Wisconsin Project use to try to get a handle on all this activity?
Well, it's a difficult research target. We've been conducting research on Iranian procurement for, you know, almost two decades, publishing a lot of this information on our Iran Watch website. Our research begins kind of at the entity level, the organizations, the companies, the individuals contributing to these various programs of concern, and then using open sources to try and sort of fill in information about these entities and who they're connected to. So we use government sanctions notices, we use corporate registry data, so you can figure out kind of who are the people behind these companies, what other companies do they own or control. We look at trade data, we look at scientific publications, we kind of bring all of this information together, and through that we can establish larger trends in terms of Iranian sanctions evasion practices.
And what kind of impact are you looking for when you determine these trends? You know, what kind of audience are you trying to reach?
A couple of different audiences. I mean, for a website like Iran Watch, of course, we're trying to reach the general public, industry. We have a lot of, you know, people consuming our data who are involved in supply chain management. So they're an audience of interest. Government officials outside of the United States who are looking to kind of understand and implement to some extent U.S. sanctions. So I would say it's a sort of a variety of people.
Can you take a look into the future here? What kinds of responses do you think Iran and its suppliers are going to make to this gradually escalating sanctions campaign by the U.S. and the West?
I think we're going to see probably more of the same, you know, setting up additional networks, establishing, you know, a number of additional front companies. I mean, it is ultimately a game of whack-a-mole, and we're often asked, you know, what's the point of what you're doing? Because Iran just sets up other companies or finds a different way around it.
So what is the point?
Well, again, the point is, you know, the more you do whack-a-mole, you know, the more tired the mole gets. It just makes it more difficult for Iran and costlier for Iran to obtain what it wants. And that's, again, that's the objective of sanctions. Sanctions aren't a policy in and of themselves. The objective is to sort of raise the cost to Iran and make it more difficult. The expectation is not that sanctions are going to totally cut off supply, particularly of these types of components, which are not sort of export controls to Iran. That's not the objective, and it shouldn't be seen as the objective.
Well, Valerie Lindsay, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Project on Nuclear Arms Control, on the line from Alexandria, Virginia. Nice of you to join us on Flashpoint Iran.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Iran. I'm Michael Lippin. Iran is facing international criticism for convicting 10 Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps military personnel this month in the 2020 shootdown of a Ukrainian passenger plane. The Iranian government has said it downed the plane by mistake minutes after it took off from Tehran, killing all 176 people on board, most of them Iranians and Canadians flying to Kiev en route to Canada. The Association of Families of Flight PS752 victims rejected the convictions, saying Iran did not prosecute the main culprits and failed to conduct a full and impartial investigation. Canada and three other countries who lost citizens in the incident also rejected Iran's move. Ali Essassi is a Canadian lawmaker from Canada's ruling party. I asked him in a Friday phone call whether Ottawa is living up to its pledge to achieve justice for the victims.
Yes, I can categorically say that since the first days after this terrible tragedy happened, the Canadian government made it abundantly clear that we would pursue this case. Now, in terms of furthering this cause, Canada has always been adamant about working with the other countries that lost loved ones as well. So for that reason, Canada was instrumental in establishing the International Coordination and Response Group, which initially was comprised of five countries, and those five were Canada, Sweden, UK, Ukraine, in Afghanistan. But unfortunately, given the developments that we have all witnessed in Afghanistan, there's been no interest on their part to move forward on this issue. But the other four are very, very keen to make sure that no stone is turned and that they honor the families of the innocent victims. And their objectives, of course, have always been to have accountability, justice, and transparency. So these four countries will definitely move forward, use every international process that is available to them to make sure that everyone understands and appreciates full well that the Iranian government is solely responsible for this terrible loss of life.
Well, when you talk about using international processes to get justice, families of the victims, they have their own organization. They've been pushing for a while to get this shoot down incident referred to an international judicial body to try to get the Iranian government on trial in that kind of forum. So what do you know about what Canada is doing to try to get such a process going?
Yes. Well, first of all, allow me to say that the association has been very, very instrumental in ensuring that the loved ones of those who perished have adopted a unified position. They've been doing a marvelous job over the course of the past 3.5 years. However, as you can appreciate full well, and I say this as someone who previously used to be an international law litigator, as you know, all international legal procedures and processes have predicates and preconditions. And that, of course, can be very time consuming. And of course, this process has been a frustratingly long and painful journey for everyone. However, I think it would be fair to say that the four countries which did lose their citizens have ensured that they comply with all the obligations, that they demonstrate that they made every effort in good faith to negotiate with Iran. The reality is that I think Iran has never cooperated. It has never allowed the truth surrounding the incident to emerge. They have never cooperated with the international investigators. And they, of course, have intimidated the relatives of the loved ones, both in Iran and those who are outside the country as well. However, these four countries have an obligation to act in good faith, demonstrate that they did want to resolve this issue. They did want to get to the bottom of it before they can commence legal proceedings.
Can you give our audience a sense of when, you know, we might actually see such proceedings and, you know, in which forum? Because as I understand it, there are two possible international judicial bodies that could be involved here.
Yes. Well, currently, as of January 8th, 2023, the four countries were obliged under international law to undertake arbitration with Iran. So the clock runs on that. 6 months after this arbitration process commenced. So that would make it, as I understand, July 8th, 2023. But as I indicated, in international law, there are a number of predicates and preconditions that any country has to comply with before you can refer the case to an international fora. And for that reason, the four countries have been acting together. They have retained lawyers, whether lawyers at their departments of foreign affairs or outside counsel, to make sure that they can proceed with this in as robust a fashion as possible.
Well, let's see what happens later this year in July in terms of having this case proceed to an international judicial body. Ali Essassi, chair of the Foreign Affairs Committee of the Canadian Parliament, speaking to us from Toronto. I appreciate you being with us on Flashpoint Iran.
Thank you very much for having me, Michael. And let me reassure you again that the four countries are committed to making sure that they are there for the families, and that accountability, justice, and transparency does ultimately prevail.
We're now at the end of this week's show. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. So glad you could join us, and hope you can do so again next week for the next Flashpoint Iran.